Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So the topic we are looking at today lies at the very perplexing nexus of where matters natural and supernatural come together. And because it's the very nexus of where matters natural and supernatural come together, this is also, without exaggeration, essential, necessary for human salvation. In other words, the dynamics that we'll look at render intelligible what Jesus came to do. So without a robust and accurate conception of the relation between, distinction between, yet continuity of the natural and the supernatural orders, salvation is not possible. So that's what's at stake. So what we will do then this morning, for briefly, is we will look at, and just to make sure we, because Mass is coming up, good, we will have a clock. The clock has disappeared. This is the Dominican House of Studies. One wonders if poltergeists are around because things get moved around and disappear all the time, including the clock. What we will do today is we're going to look at how and why and the manner in which these things unfold. Then we will present briefly some Thomistic distinctives that are relevant to these questions, particularly vis-a-vis the nature of sacred theology and also the nature of philosophy. And then we'll look at a couple personal and practical implications about why this matters to our lives, okay? All right, so it, very interestingly, when you look at the Summa Theologiae, which is St. Thomas Aquinas' masterpiece on Sacra Doctrina, it is a masterpiece that basically was a revolutionary document because in the general prologue of the Summa Theologiae, he lists three impediments to education in the medieval university. And what he does by listing those three impediments, he basically points to the day job of the professor of theology at the University of Paris and says, this is not working. Disputations confuse students. There's too much repetition. Commenting on texts. He's not talking about the sentences of Peter Lombard because you don't teach from the sentences of Peter Lombard. What's he talking about? He's talking about lecturing through the Bible. He did not downplay the Bible. But it was not ordained and ordered in a pedagogically coherent way. It's not its purpose. The sacred text of Scripture is not intended to be a textbook of sacred theology. And so what he proposes to do in the Summa Theologiae is to present the Sacra Doctrina, the holy teaching, according to an ordo disciplinae method and formality. So he's bringing together divine revelation, Sacra Doctrina, but a pedagogically proportioned, accurate, and effective method of instruction. And so this is why St. Thomas, I propose, would not have been surprised that his Summa took so long to be used, because it was really a document that he knew the contemporary, his contemporary academic structures could not sustain. Now, following that, one might think that grace and nature questions come up in at the end of the Prima Secundae. The sections on grace are at the end of the first part of the second part, roughly questions 109 through 113. If you put merit in, that's question 114. However, when you look at what the Thomist tradition, namely those students of Aquinas, studying St. Thomas, where they bring up nature and grace distinctions, the relation between the ordination of the natural to the supernatural, where does it appear? It appears in the very beginning. So this is a fascinating point. In Summa Theologiae, Prima Pars, question one, right out of the gate, article one, this is where many of the greatest Thomists in history, Cajetan, Banez, John of St. Thomas, etc., consider our topic today on the question of the natural and the supernatural. And what does question one talk about? It talks about the very nature of sacra doctrina, holy teaching or sacred doctrine. So from the very beginning of the Summa, in its ordo disciplinae structure and orientation and method, the question of nature and grace, St. Thomas believes, and we can evidence this, if you want to use the modern word of reception, in the reception of the Thomists, they located in the Thomistic form the question of the natural and supernatural relation right here at the very beginning. So we could say that the distinction and integration of the natural and the supernatural is at the very beginning of the Summa Theologiae. And why is that? It's because when he asks in Article 1 of Question 1, why do we need a holy teaching, a sacred doctrine? He provides a twofold, an answer that has two dimensions. First, God is a quendam finem. God is a kind of end that surpasses the native, natural, purely rational capacities of human intellection and volition to arrive at. Because God is an end which exceeds the natural specifications and limitations of the human person, because God is a quendam finem, a kind of end, and we need a quandam doctrinam, a teaching, a kind of teaching that is proportioned to this supernatural finality. And then he goes on, makes it even more explicit. What is the connection between God's supernatural finality and the sacra doctrina, the holy teaching that God reveals? The union between the two, Aquinas explicitly states, are so that we can order our intentiones et actiones, intentions and actions to the supernatural end. You cannot arrive at an end that you truly arrive at. It's truly your journey if you, as a human being, a rational nature possessing person, which is a human person, having a rational nature, unless you can order your intellect and your will, your intentions and your actions to the supernatural finality. So it's within this overarching big picture structure of the whole of sacra doctrina that the dynamics of nature and grace reside, and quite frankly, everything else within the Summa Theologiae. So God is an end which surpasses the native limits and specificity of the human person. In order for us to be able to arrive at that end and have that teleological orientation, that entelechy, that divine entelechy realized in our actions, we need a doctrina, a teaching, a pedagogical formality that can inform and indeed transform our capacity to know and to love and even to be. This is the foundation for the Sacra Doctrina, for the Summa Theologiae, and for our topic. We can't do it here. One of the fascinating things, too, is if you look at the objections, not just the responses to the objections, but the objections of St. Thomas in Article 1, they're brilliantly constructed. Remember, the distinction between the disputed questions and the Summa is Aquinas didn't necessarily, he might have edited the disputed questions objections. He didn't write them. Each of the objections in the Summa, Aquinas wrote them. It's all from him. And what he does in Objection 1 and Objection 2 is he looks at the possibility of another discipline, another science beyond the philosophical disciplines from the side of being and from the side of knowledge. And basically it's fascinating because they're so brilliantly set up. It's almost as if the objection for sacra doctrina is to say, look, you'd have to have another discipline that's outside of the domain of being, And you'd also have to have another discipline, the putative Sacra Doctrina discipline, that's outside the human capacity to know. Both of those are impossible, therefore both Sacra Doctrina, but because of both of that, Sacra Doctrina is impossible. And Thomas masterfully responds to both of them because he masterfully set up conjunctively the two objections. So that leads us here. It does seem to be a problem. Because if we are after salvation, we know Sacra Doctrina is not just real, but also necessary. And yet, and we know that these are the parts through which the human person navigates, and within which objectively the supernatural finality of God, our salvation, the doctrina which enables us to arrive at God through our intentions and our actions. But there is still the paradox we adverted to earlier, and that paradox is this. How is it that a creature, a finite creature, which is what a creature is, can be united to arrive at a supernatural end, an end beyond its nature? That's the first thing. From the side of the end, this seems to be a troubling prospect. It's one thing to be liberated from your sin and your disorder. It's another thing to have as your end, my end, something which no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the mind of man conceived, you know, the divine goodness. That's big. And to have a real unity, not just going to the museum and pointing at some art like I do that I don't have any idea. I can go through a museum in 3 minutes. There's a picture that looks like a man, that looks like I don't know. Where's the gift shop? Where's the coffee shop? I'm done. We could do that for the divine goodness, but clearly whenever we talk about divine finality, there's an intimacy of union with God as the supernatural end, where he is a supernatural object. He is our supernatural objective. How does that happen? So on the side of the end, this is hard to see how this can happen. Now, on the side of us, of the agent, the actor moving to the supernatural, and we also have another problem. Assuming that I can have God for my supernatural end, that I can be raised from my purely natural limitations, operations, formality to a supernatural level, how can I remain what I still am, which is natural, while I'm operating on what is by definition above my natural capacities? This is the ultimate problem for Christian theology to consider, and it's at the root of everything, whether it be sacraments, Christology, virtue, theory, creation, etc., the missions, etc., etc. Okay, so what we want to do is to identify then principles of continuity between me pre-grace, between me on a, for lack of a better word, natural level, putting aside for the moment, of course, all of us exist in original sin, a state of original sin before baptism. Original sin is only a mystery of the faith that is known through divine revelation. Therefore, we're not starting at neutral because of original sin, but actually we have certain defects, disordered tendencies because of original sin. We're going to put that to the side for the moment because we don't have enough time. So we're just speaking now about our natural being. How is it then that our natural being can be supernaturalized while retaining its natural constitutive elements? This means that when we talk about the human person having a human nature, we must be able to and have to identify and home in upon two levels of human naturalness, what it means to be a human person. And this is where all of the philosophy is supremely important. We can talk, first of all, about form, and then we can talk about operation. Form is known in the scholastic precision language, first act. Operation, of course, is known as second act. Form pertains to what we might call the act of existence. So by our very existence as a created being, if I am real, I actually exist. I have a form that gives me, sustains me in my actual existence. And this formality extends both to the order of esse, having being, being real, and also intelligibility. Through knowledge, it's exactly the form that I understand. I'm informed by what I understand. So first act matters a lot. The form matters a lot. But also, as we know, St. Thomas says, and it makes sense even if we think about it for but a few moments, first act in creatures is ordered to second act. Namely, it is insufficient to human flourishing and perfection to simply be, but with our being, we are ordered to operation, to doing things with our operation. All things that are, operate. All things that act in terms of existence, act, do actions, operations, ordered to the attainment of their finality. And so if grace, then, is going to enter into the dynamics of and truly transform, even those words, it has to be able to touch upon first act and second act. It has to touch upon our existence, our nature, and also touch upon our operations. Obviously, this is what St. Thomas more explicitly invokes, the operational aspects in Summa Theologiae, question 1, article 1. But one can't operate except insofar as they have a nature and they have an actual existence and that they do have their form. So both of them are related. Now, as a footnote, separated, you might know that within the Thomist tradition, there has been a great controversy about whether or not there's such a thing as pure nature. In puris naturalibus, or as some people say in less refined Latin, natura pura. Several things by way of footnote, and these both apply directly to this. First, the state of pure nature never existed. No one ever thought that Adam and Eve were running around in kind of an innocent, cherub-like naturalness. From the very beginning of their creation, it's an article of faith, they were created in the state of original justice, which means they had already divine grace infused in their heart and their soul. They were supernaturalized. So no Thomist at no time ever thought that there was ever a moment when you had human persons, human creatures, without any grace. They could have, but that never happened. What, then, do we think about the state or the possibility of pure nature as a principle? The pure nature as a principle question in the debates over philosophy and theology relate to the fact that you need to have a principle of continuity between the natural and the supernatural. Very important point. So this obviously brings the physicist, the natural philosopher, back to the utmost important principle of prime matter, which is the principle of potency. Now, if you have a log, so Jordan, I know you're an outdoorsman, you're from Montana, right? So Jordan's up in Montana, driving around in his truck. And he goes up to cuts down a tree. We have a log. Wonderful. This is real Midwestern, virile cowboy man living life. And he takes that log. It's dry somehow. Good, already. We burn it. Now what do we have? We burn that log, and it is now charcoal. Prime matter is what remains constant between the log, the burning log, and the charcoal. Charcoal and log are different, and yet there is some connection between them. And you can't articulate motion or change without some principle of continuity. And so prime matter, although it's never found as prime, remains constant throughout that change, or else you would have completely different substances that have no continuity between them. So the form of woodness, the form of fire, and the form of charcoal, those are different forms. Fire, wood, and charcoal are not identical substances. They are substantially different. But the principle of continuity between them is prime matter. Why is that important? It's because causality then can really bring about a change in something. Remember the definition of motion or change, the activation of a potency insofar as it is in potency. Now in the Christian life, the principle of pure nature is like prime matter. You never bump into prime matter walking down the street, because to do so, it would have to have first act. And the moment it has first act, it exists, and then it can bump into you, which would be a second act. You've got a form. It's no longer prime. Pure nature is analogous to prime matter. It is the principle of continuity between nature, human nature, without grace, so to speak, and in a graced and even glorified state. This is why it's absolutely imperative to maintain the principle of nature, even in abstraction from the supernatural, because without that, we would not have real salvation. You would be a completely different creature. If there was nothing continuous, no principle of continuity between me, my fallen state, my baptized state, my glorified state, we could not speak of salvation. We could only speak of new creation in the most radical way. And yet, nature does persist in different states throughout the dynamics of salvation. And because there is such an identifiable principle as pure nature that resides from pre-conversion, post-conversion, sacramental life to glory, we can have salvation. This is very, very important. If I had to say one thing, it's that without pure nature, you and I could not be saved. Because if there were no continuity between me and my sinful state and the me and my glorified state, I'm not really saved. That's a new me. But that's not salvation. That's a new creation. And not just metaphorically, completely. And so where am I? I'm annihilated. And then we have very interesting, we can move into the annihilation controversies and things like that. But that's not quite, obviously, that's not good news. That's an other news. You know, it's not good news for you. It's other news. You will be something completely different. Now, this brings about this talk about grace. Notice, even within the discussion of the principle of continuity between the natural and the supernatural orders under the motion and the formality of grace, we are already homing in on the fact that grace touches on first act. It touches on the soul in its essence. But grace, and this is very important as well, is not substantial. It is accidental. It's an entitative quality that changes and qualifies the soul in a profound, radical even way, but because we don't want the order of grace to completely destroy human nature, because again, then you could not have salvation, you'd have a new creation in a radical way. Grace is an accident. It is something that God creates within the soul that qualifies and elevates the essence of the soul, and because the essence of the soul, also the powers of intellect and will. Now, lest we think this sounds underwhelming, we know what accident, so like hair color, famous example of accident, height, you know, beardedness or not with the human person. They say, man, this kind of makes grace rather menial. Isn't grace, it's a participation of the divine life and being. Accidents, it seems like that's below the dignity of grace. Now, as all the philosophers here can point out, yes, accidents are by definition not substantial, they're not essential in terms of their specificity, however, they matter a great deal. So height is an accident. A human person is still a human person, whether they're 5 feet or 6 feet or 7 feet. However, if you are 20 feet tall, that's an accident. However, your life will be radically different than someone who's like myself, you know, 6.5 feet. No, okay, I know, I'm sorry. 5'8" on a good day. Your accidents matter. Similarly, IQ, that's accidental to having rationality, how smart we are in terms of being able to calculate and reflect. However, if you have an IQ of 90 versus an IQ of, let's say, 350, whatever that would look like, your life will also be very different. So just as an en passant observation, do not think that accidents don't matter. Accidents, although they are not substantial, they do shape substances in a very profound way. And in fact, it's through accidents that we often, most of the time, have understanding of substances. Okay. So grace then enters into nature. We also don't collect grace. This is the modern view. It's almost like grace is like Ave Eternal manna that God just sprinkles out into the atmosphere. And then you go out after Mass, you've listened, you know, you've been to a focus conference or a TI event. You just feel wonderful and you're like, I need to live in grace. And so you just walk around the Ave Eternal atmosphere and collect grace. I need to get more grace today. That is not how grace works, because as an accident, grace, in its habitual qualitative terminal nature, it is created in your soul with custom, precision, and execution. Which means any habitual grace as a habitus, a quality of the soul, a habit of the soul that enters into the soul, that is custom fit and deployed for you and for me from God. So God, when he gives you grace, and if we reduce that to causality on a part on the side of efficient causality, what we're saying is that God himself, literally as efficient cause, comes down into your soul and graces you, qualifies you in a way that reflects his own being. So grace is like more analogous to the archer's arrow than it is to Ave Eternal manna sprinkled around the world. Once we have this habitual grace, this therefore provides the foundation for both the continuity that we have between the supernatural and the natural order, and for the discontinuity. The discontinuity that emerges within the fundamental continuity of the natural and the supernatural orders is grounded in the fact that grace gives us a participation in something beyond us, namely the divine life, and yet we are not essentially graced. This is where St. Thomas, in question 110 of the Prima Secundae, article 2, as I recall, he explains, I think it's odd too, of Article 2. He explains that one of the fascinating paradoxes of grace as received in the soul is that in itself, as a thing, its sublimity exceeds the dignity of our humanity because it's a participation in supernatural being, and we are not supernatural. So when you and I have sanctifying grace, please God, we all do, that as a being, as a quality, exceeds in dignity my own natural constitution. And yet, vis-a-vis me as an existing thing, grace living within me, so to speak, it has an inferior status because it is a habitus that is below the stability and the firmity of me and my other natural constitutive powers, because I can lose grace and I can't lose rationality or volitionality, or, you know, my nature. This paradox between grace being beyond us in itself and yet being something that does not attain the same firmness and sublimity of our nature, this is critical for understanding the continuity and the discontinuity between nature and grace. Once we have a form that resides within the essence of the soul, then we are enabled to consider how this grace, this habit, this habitus interacts with human action and intentions. And this is where Thomas is very clear. Grace is not a virtue. A virtue is a habitus, a habitual form that resides and qualifies and perfects in a stable, perfective manner the powers of the soul. Grace resides in the essence of the soul, but because the powers of the soul reside in the soul and the essence of the soul works operationally, second act, through the powers, therefore, those that have sanctifying grace, habitual grace, they can perform supernatural actions through their powers of intellection and volition. And these, of course, are the through the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. Grace leads to a qualification and an elevation in the powers. And because of that qualification and elevation in the powers, our operations can have a supernatural objectivity. This, therefore, is why St. Thomas saves the treatise on grace until the end of the Prima Secunda. It's very interesting. When you look at the Prima Secunda, he starts with the end, then he goes through action, then he goes through virtue, or passions and virtue, then he goes through law, and he saves grace until the very end of his fundamental aspects of moral theology. Why does he do that? It's because only after we've looked at, in the Prima Pars, he looks at the human nature. Then at the beginning of the Prima Secunda, he looks at how human operation works. He frames grace as informing and transforming the entirety of this canvas of human being, first act and second act in human operation. Only at the end can we appreciate how profoundly grace transforms. Couple more points before we move to the spiritual thing. Are we supposed to go 45 minutes, Father Davenport? All right, good. So we won't. Okay, we'll go just a little bit more, and then we'll start winding down. Why is it that rational nature alone can receive grace? It is because rational nature alone, although natural, again, we're talking created rationality can be subject to this elevation in a way that non-rational created nature cannot, because created rationality, and also with rationality, volitionality, of course, because the will is the rational appetite, they can be ordered to immaterial being and goodness. That's the key. Even if they do not, the intellect and will, know infinite or spiritual things, which they do if they're around at all, but let's just say, for the sake of argument, that it were possible to only know sensible goods and not to abstract, they would still be able to. Animals, non-rational animals, can never get beyond to the consideration of spiritual entities or spiritual beings because they don't know universals, which are immaterial by definition. And so it's through the fact that the objectivity of the intellect and the objectivity of the will can be activated by objects that are spiritual beyond the natural range of created cognition and volition, that only created cognition and volition can be so elevated. So, the intellect's ordered to know being, which means that I can know the being of something sensible through the process of abstraction, sense knowledge, resolution, all that, which we know. But I can also know something about the being of God. Why is that? It's because God is a being. He's a being beyond me. But that is not inimical to human contemplation, rational contemplation. For non-rational animals, they are limited merely to sense knowledge, and God is not sensible. They're limited to sense appetitional affection and desire, and God is not sensible. This ties into what the Thomist tradition is referred to as obediential potency, namely, that the powers, the capacities of human nature, intellect, and will to be elevated to a supernatural objective or object like God, it is beyond the native activation of inherent within the potencies of human nature. However, it is not dissonant with. So I will never exert by myself a supernatural knowledge of God. However, if God proposes himself, quandam doctrinam, as a supernatural object of knowledge. The intellect says, whoa, I couldn't have found this by myself, but yet this is within the objectivity, the formal objectivity of what my comprehension, my cognition can reach. That's what obediential potency refers to fundamentally. The fact that the human powers of rationality can be expanded to the supernatural level without being compromised. Okay, let's talk about a few spiritual implications, summarizing a few spiritual implications. First, nature and grace is a paradox because it bespeaks the fact that human nature can be raised beyond itself while remaining what it is itself. That is necessary for salvation because were we expanded so far beyond ourselves, we're no longer ourselves, we would not be saved. We would be annihilated in a new creation, and there wouldn't be a we, it would be a me and then a that. Not good for my salvation. God does this because he has made himself, and by this I mean the supernatural perfective orientation and formality of grace, because he is an end that surpasses our native grasp, our native access through our intentions and our actions. And so from the very beginning, St. Thomas says that the Summa Theologiae, as an expression of Sacra Doctrina, is ordered to our attainment, our pursuit of God's supernatural finality, because we can't order our intentions and actions to something that we don't know that it is. Within this cognitive and this ontological nexus of supernatural being, supernatural knowledge, we can recognize then why and how grace must be something that touches upon the fundamental constitutive principles of human beingness, first act. It's an accidental quality that shapes me in my being. And because it shapes me in my being, it can also shape me in my actions, my operations. Faith, hope, and charity, operations, sanctifying grace with regard to the quality of the soul. Because of that, we now also recognize that pure nature is a significant principle of continuity between the natural and the supernatural orders, because nature is related to the subject in which grace inheres. Grace does not destroy nature. It fits as a qualitative perfection of nature that enables nature to remain from a pre-graced state to a post-graced state, while also elevating nature beyond its native capacities. In conclusion, two practical implications for this, one speculatively and then one spiritually. Speculatively, it is often thought that Thomism, Scotism, Bonaventurianism, you know, Occamism, all these other schools, the great question today is how do we distinguish and unify them? And what you might notice, and why Father Davenport has kindly has this theology section here, it's to show that how within the dynamics of what theology is, that's faith seeking understanding, how do we account for the role of philosophy in the role of theology, faith seeking understanding? It has been said to me that Thomas Aquinas had not just his philosophical principles, but also his theological principles that specified Thomism. That's a problem. Why is that? It's because what are the theological principles of sacred theology? It's nothing else than the divine revelation God has revealed. Now, if Thomas has his own principles, his own divine revelation, and Scotus has his own, and Bonaventure has his own, and Father Rees has his own, we've got at least four or five churches going on. Different religions. So what unifies all Catholic theologians is not that they have different theological principles. What are the theological principles? They are preeminently summarized in the Creed, which we will recite in a little bit. Those are the starting points. That's what God has revealed to us because they would exceed our native capacity to discover or our ability to discover with facility, in the case of the Preambula Fidei. So therefore, what does specify the different schools? It is not the faith element, those would be theological principles, but the understanding element, which means what philosophical presuppositions do we bring to The Journey in Theology of Faith-Seeking Understanding. Give an example. It's an article of the faith. This is my body. Scotus holds this, Aquinas holds this, Bonaventure holds this, Molina holds this, Suarez holds this, Davenport holds this. We all hold this. Or we're not Catholic. But when we begin to, what does this mean? What we think is, will change what we think this is my body means. And so that means a Scotistic understanding of isness versus a Thomistic understanding of isness versus a Suarezian understanding of isness, just to give examples, or a Balthasarian, they can all be authentically Catholic because they accept the same divinely revealed first principles of theology. But when it comes to the work of theology, which is seeking understanding, faith-seeking understanding, it is the philosophy that specifies as applied to the work of sacred theology. So all of the philosophical work that we do, that Davenport does, that Father Reese does, and all of these other dear colleagues do, is very important for the theologian because basically theology has forgotten this. We have, in theology today, if you say syllogism, they think philosophy. When in the end, what specifies theology is not if you're thinking discursively, but if you're starting with supernatural or natural first principles. Last thing, the spiritual implication. So basically, that's an exhortatio to say, get the philosophy fixed and theology will be a lot better. And theology is doing horribly right now because no one can spell being. Yeah, that's really it. I'm not exaggerating. Okay. Second thing, spiritually. When it comes to human life, sin is a problem. And it creates questions within the dynamics of grace. Why, Lord, when I pray sincerely and earnestly to know and to love you, do I not do what I should do? I disordered operations. And I go to confession, okay, grace is restored, come back, and yet I can't retain affective union with you. Usually things related to chastity and purity on the internet, self-harm, food, etc. These are the big things. How does all of this fit into the real dynamics of Christian salvation? First, nature will never, ever, 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 ever lose its fundamental orientation and inclination to truth and goodness. Which means no matter how sinful I might be, no matter how disordered we might be, there will never come a day when objectively disordered finalities and moral objects perfect us. Even the most inveterate sinner is still within their nature pointing towards truth and goodness. So that's the first thing. You never become objectively evil. Jansen, Calvin, and Luther are wrong. Second thing, well, how then within us does this work? This is where we remember that of the three principles of being, we have act, we have potency, and we have privation. Sin is a privation. It's a deactivation, a disactivation, disordered within a potency. Potency is ordered to act. They're really distinct. Act perfects and specifies the potency. Anytime you talk about a being, human nature is a being, these principles, this is where sin is. What is the solution, both for a potency that wants to be supernaturalized, even if it doesn't have a privation, it's theological act. God is a supernatural object. Also, what is the solution for a privation, namely a potency that is moving in the wrong direction, so to speak? It's still perfective act. It's God. Which means that in the principles of being, the theological graced activation, remaining united to Jesus, is the key. And this is what I'll close with. In 3 minutes, Father, so we'll still have 10 minutes of Q&A. Years ago, when I was an undergrad, I went to a very Catholic college, and it was kind of a mortal sin not to love the little flower, St. Therese. And I tried. Saint Therese of Lisieux. And I tried. I read her Journal of a Soul. Tried it a couple times. I kept getting to the Christmas shoes tantrum. And I was just like, I just cannot get into this. So that was undergrad. Then I come to the Order of Friars Preachers. And I'd always been Thomistic and things. But so was I. And I started reading at the recommendation of a friend, one of our priests. Her last sayings when she's dying. It's very touching, her little kind of sayings that she would say as she's suffering. It's like, oh, there's some consonance here with Thomistic metaphysics and physics and theology. No surprise. I knew that. I just couldn't see it. But then I started looking at all the history and the biography of this. Then I discovered something that is wonderful, and I want to end with this. Saint Therese of Lisieux, in her mature religious years, she didn't live to be very old, of course, but she was a novice mistress, which means when you entered the Carmel in Lisieux, you would have her for a couple years overseeing your formation. And one of the sisters who came to the Lisieux Carmel, the Lisieux Monastery, was a sister named Marie of the Trinity. Not Elizabeth, that's a saint, this is Marie of the Trinity. Marie of the Trinity is interesting. She was a Parisian. She had started in Paris and had tried a few years before to become a Carmelite in Paris, which is, of course, the metropolitan capital of the world for the French. But she got ill, so she had to leave, got better, and then she re-entered, but this time a monastery in Lisieux, France. And while she was there, Therese is talking about what is known as her little way. And Marie is listening to it, and after she died, she told all of the canonical investigators this, which is why we know about it. She says, oh, Sister Therese, this is fascinating, your little way about smallness and God's greatness. This sounds a lot like what I heard back in Paris. And Therese was shocked. She said, someone else is saying the little way? That's wonderful. She goes, oh, yeah, before I got sick and had to leave the monastery in Paris, we had a Dominican Thomist come to preach our retreat. And he used different words, but I took the notes, and Therese was thrilled. She says, oh, give me these notes. And this is what, and then when Therese read this, she said, this is exactly my little way. I'm deeply consoled that a theologian of the school of St. Thomas Aquinas is saying the same thing. And when she would write letters after this, she would use what I'm about to share with you from the tome of the Dominicans preaching. So she became a Thomist, we would say. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. No, of course, it's God's one. It's truth. It's truth. Okay, here's what the Dominican Thomist said. He says, sisters, he's preaching to nuns, and this is what the notes. He says, remember, he says, the number zero, sorry, I don't have a lot of space, is the most miserable of numbers. Because whether you have one zero or two zeros or 1,000 zeros, they all equal zero. He says, however, if you place one zero behind, united to the number one, or two zeros behind, united to the number one, or 1,000 zeros behind, united to the number one, in their very nothingness, they participate and receive, and one even can say extend, the efficacy of the one. And he says, Carmelites, all of us, we're not ashamed of our inherent inability to actualize our potencies supernaturally or to deal with our privations. The solution is always to run to the one who is the principle of activation. And when Therese would write letters, she would tell people after this, remember, you're like a zero, Jesus is the one. So she began to use this. All this is a Thomist way of trying to talk about how act one is what perfects, heals, activates privation and potency. So dear friends, in your life, do not for one second believe that disordered activity specifies you. It does not. You're ordered permanently for truth and goodness. And secondly, with regard to second act operation, that's the problem. That's where sin is, and that's where holiness is achieved. We do it through holding on to our Lord with deliberateness, intensity, regularity. And we don't do that by contemplating our brokenness, by trying to squeeze out of zeroness a one. That's the Suarezian and Scotistic error. But to run to the one.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.